Thanks for coming. If you're not aware, this is a regular series. We have one more planned for December. It's a very different event. It's a cookbook event, but come anyway. Sure. I think this is all the volume I can get on this thing. So please sign up for the mailing list on your way out. We have the best series in town, we think. Tonight, we celebrate, I mean, long-awaited is an understatement, the long-awaited publication of the exegesis of Philip K. Dick, the most beautiful brick of a book that you could ever look at. You're going to spend the new year on it and another year or two. We have five people here to talk about it. Laura Leslie, one of Philip K. Dick's daughters, who has been responsible for her father's estate since his death in 1982. She recently organized his manuscript materials and has created an extensive catalog. Also, Issa Dick Hackett, co-founder along with her sister of Electric Shepherd Productions, which is dedicated to the stewardship and adaptation of Philip K. Dick's library. She served as executive producer on the Adjustment Bureau and has worked with other films. Jonathan Lethem, who we regard as our own, even though he left the store to do a few other things many years ago, author of eight novels and a new book of nonfiction that we happen to have. And I think we can convince him to sign a few after the event. It's called The Ecstasy of Influence. It's just out. Pamela Jackson, who we also claim as our own because she worked here until she left to do a few other things, an independent scholar, editor. Her 1999 dissertation, The World Philip K. Dick Made, initiated a decade study of Dick's exegesis. She's done a beautiful job of editing this book. And a special guest star. I've been tweeting like mad, but you know, you probably don't read the most tweets, but Eric Davis is here also to talk about the book. Writer and award-winning journalist. His most recent book is Nomad Codes, Adventures in Modern Esoterica. We had copies this morning. I think we sold out when word was out that he was coming, but we might have a couple left. Please welcome our participants. We are honored to have them.
I'm going to speak just a little bit informally and probably ramblingly about my own connection to this project and how, and a bit about the context for it. Turning the mic on.
There you go. Better? Okay. Hey there. So let me just talk a little bit about how I got involved in this and what I think it is. I mean, describing this book is something you could kind of spend all day doing, but Philip K. Dick, as probably many of you know, was one of the great underground science fiction writers of the 20th century until a little bit later when he was recognized, I think, and increasingly is accepted as simply one of the greatest American novelists of the 20th century, albeit one who worked his entire life in a kind of from a kind of marginal position. And he's, you know, his first real fame came within the science fiction community when he won the Hugo Award, the biggest award that community has, for his 1962 novel, The Man in the High Castle. And then, there's too many great titles to name, but if you jump 20 years from that point to the year, unfortunately, that he also died, Blade Runner, a very famous and seminal and influential science fiction film, was made by Ridley Scott from one of his great novels of the later 60s, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And in some ways, that moment helped spearhead very slowly the increased interest that led to his canonization and his books all being back in print and also very widely studied He's, you know, he's both a kind of a an author who's received a real popular embrace by readers and has become very canonical in academia and cultural studies in an incredibly gratifying way in the years since his death. Dick was a big influence on me. When I was a teenager, I read all his novels and decided I wanted to write just like him. And I also had the idea that I would come out to California and meet him, but I didn't manage to do that before he died. But I did come out here and do what seemed to me at the time the next best thing, which was introduce myself to a man named Paul Williams, who was at that time helping Laura and Issa by kind of maintaining the estate such as it was. It was a strange estate in that the author's books were all out of print and had no apparent commercial prospects, although there was a strong kind of cult interest in them, and there were already some very interesting inquiries from filmmakers, including, of course, Blade Runner coming along. But what happened for me was that I got involved in a kind of really interesting tiny subculture of fans who were helping kind of keep the flame lit by publishing something called the Philip K. Dick Society Newsletter. I think the subscriber base was hovered around 800 people internationally for the years that the newsletter was being put together. And I actually did some of my very first writing in small critical pieces that were published in that newsletter. And in that time, when even the very prospect of his books coming back into print seemed kind of a marvelous fantasy, and it, you know, wasn't necessarily likely, word had kind of gone out in a small way that there was a very large trove of unpublished writings, and that these writings were of an esoteric, philosophical nature. They weren't fiction, and that Dick himself had called them his exegesis, which made it sound in some ways like a very consummated or finished or complete thing. But in fact, if you learned about this trove of writings, well, the information was all fascinating. It was actually somewhere between 8,000 and 9,000 pages, mostly handwritten, although there's a percentage of them that are typewritten, mostly unrevised, completely unrevised. A few sections might have been worked over a bit. Written over the course of the last 8 years of Dick's life as a result of a series of, you know, revelatory experiences he felt he'd had, clues, incomplete insights into the nature of existence and the universe, and that had compelled him urgently to commit his thoughts to paper and to try to sort out what he'd experienced, the glimmers of insight he'd experienced. And these became his exegesis. They also were notions that had become familiar to fans of Dick's because he alludes to them in his last three, and then it turned out a fourth novel, a kind of unpublished novel that came to light after his death. So there are intimations of this material in the last three books published during his lifetime, which were sometimes called the Valis trilogy and have generally been grouped together. The first of them is called Valis, and then there's the Divine Invasion and the Transmigration of Timothy Archer. But of course, all these books only give tiny, tiny inklings of what that kind of writing might have been like. His preoccupations in those years are indicated, but what the exegesis itself consisted of remained quite mysterious to people, and those who had heard of it became very provoked and very, very intrigued, but it was also regarded in a lot of ways as a kind of, what would you call it, sort of the bridge too far, an unpublishable, incomprehensible mass of leavings that would never be described or archived or let alone published within our lifetimes. Well, you know, here we are. Strangely enough, we find that we've managed to do something with it. And there were many stops along the journey. Paul Williams himself, you know, made very initial forays with the help of a scholar named Jake Kinney. They transcribed a few snatches of it here and there. And then Dick's biographer, Lawrence Sutton, made deeper forays and ended up publishing a volume in, somebody help me, 92, that was a kind of a less than 300 pages of excerpts, highly distilled excerpts from it, the bits and pieces he thought would be most accessible to people. So that gave a little window into it. And then, you know, well, I'm going to have to cut this story short so that other people can speak here, but we sort of cut to my friendship with Pamela. She's writing here at Cal in the rhetoric department, writing a dissertation about the last phase of Dick's writing life, which I guess depended very heavily on Sutton's volume of excerpts, and it was an inquiry into what she could have, you know, what she could see of the exegesis. And you know, I'd sort of gone back to New York and lost touch with the estate, but then many years later was introduced for the first time to Laura and Issa, and among the topics that came up was this idea that maybe somehow actually the exegesis was something that should be approached. We just visualized ways this might happen, and truthfully, if you'd said at that time that it was going to happen as quickly as it did, or that it would happen from a major New York publisher, I think we would have kind of laughed. I was envisioning, even as I was representing, I think, the optimistic wing, I was thinking that it would be a scholarly edition, or maybe a small press, maybe perhaps even just an imprint dedicated to this one project that would sort of arise as a nonprofit or a kind of a crowdsourced project in order to get the thing available to some people who would care to see it. But anyway, the conversation, you know, was intermittent. And then when Pamela agreed to spearhead the project, it suddenly took on some life. She'd gone on, very fortunately, from her dissertation work to become a trained archival librarian. So she sort of had a unique double qualification as a scholar of the exegesis and someone who was trained in dealing with archival materials to make this, you know, what was really a very brave foray into this 9,000-page disaster area, and come out with something more or less like a book, enough of one that we could propose it to Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and have them say yes. And then suddenly, of course, there was this deadline. we'll carry this story forward from there. There's lots about the process of editing it and bringing it to the point where you can hold it in your hands that's terrifically worth describing, but I'm going to let some other people speak. Laura, do you want to kind of talk a little bit from the estate's perspective next?
Sure. Thank you so much. So you have to understand that this document took up two filing cabinet drawers. Thank you. This isn't my foray, I usually hide in the background. But so we have been, Issa and I have been responsible for all these materials that have found a life in publishing. Some things haven't found a life in publishing, and the exegesis was really intimidating to us. Every once in a while, we'd try to dig into it on our own and start reading it, and it's very information dense. And I have to say that when I read it, I would sit there originally with a dictionary and where's my library of philosophy? And a library of philosophy or dictionary of philosophy, and try to, since I'm not a philosophy major, which I'm sort of jealous of all you that are, because you get a deeper meaning than I think I'll ever be able to. But really tried to understand this, and I loved what you said. You said it's the blind man's elephant, right? It's like, or maybe you said Philip K. Dick's the blind man's elephant. But this thing was intimidating and overwhelming, and we started becoming comfortable that there was enough known about our father that we knew that there was this experience in 74. We're pretty challenged to bounce that from a daughter's perspective and to bounce it as a responsibility to his legacy, the scholars and the fans' perspective, and we knew we would publish it. And so about 7 years ago, we got mentally ready. We're like, probably one of the key things was Jonathan getting our father inducted into the Library of America. And if you've been told your father's been, was crazy your entire life, it's pretty hard to deal with sometimes. And I knew him. He wasn't crazy. In fact, when we were in L.A. doing a panel in L.A., we were in the elevator, and these guys go, oh, yeah, we're going to see the Philip K. Dick panel. He was crazy. He was as crazy as Bedbug. And I'm like, really? And so then, of course, I outed myself right then and there. And I said, Pamela, what do you think? You've been in my father's mind for a long time, the last 3 years. Was he crazy? She goes, no, I don't think he was crazy. What'd you say, manic depressive? Something like that, but not schizophrenic, whatever. But so we've tried to balance this. We feel very strongly that our responsibility is to not edit who Philip K. Dick was, that he was who he was, good, bad, and indifferent. Some things make us squeamish and are incredibly uncomfortable. I mean, no young woman, and I was 22 when my father died, wants to read about a girl that he has a crush on. You just don't. But this journey was pretty amazing because we were told, no, nobody will ever publish this, nobody will ever publish this. But we did this underground thing with Pamela, and we were funding her on this very limited basis and meeting with her and talking about it, and Jonathan's mentoring us. And Pamela and Jonathan, we just had a moment of serendipity, I would say, and they rose to the occasion. They put together an outline, sort of a document that described what this was so that a non-Philip K. Dick commercial publisher would understand what it was. And oh my God, they gave us an advance. So we actually used that advance to fund the team that worked on this. In fact, I went back and I said, could you give us a little more advance? Because there's a lot of people on the team and we wanted to do right by those people as best we could. And they did. I'd never been in this experience. It was pretty fun. So So that's how we got here, and I have to say that Pamela was very conscientious for us as the children of Philip K. Dick. We were worried there were things that would... The only rule that we have is if there's someone living, we won't publish something that would hurt them. It's not necessary, and we'll wait until, 20 years or whatever, 50 years from now. And when she found one very minor... component, one name, and she just changed the name. We talked about it, and we just changed the name. So I have to say that our fears, we've grown. It's been almost 30 years in February since our father passed away, and our comfort level and our maturity and this big responsibility that we take really seriously, sometimes it's very overwhelming, has allowed us to be here with you today with this book. So we're very excited about that, and it's as much as we could get through a commercial publisher. And the rest will be out someday, completely accessible. I think the technology's there. We have to get there. Can I give this to someone?
Great. Thanks. Issa, do you want to say something to me?
Probably just Laura said it all. But just really appreciate being here. This is like coming back home, sort of full circle. We met with Pamela for the first time here, and of course this was where her father grew up and did a lot of his early stories, so it's pretty special to be here. So thanks for all the support. Thanks for everybody. Friends, family, and fans.
So, yes, again.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we'll save Eric. We'll save you for a little bit further along. Eric comes in and enormously crucial intervention in this publishing process. But Pamela, do you want to talk a bit about your experience of having this this monster delivered to your doorstep and what you did?
So I had no idea what to expect, really. Well, some idea, because I had read about the exegesis first in Valis, where it was a main character of that autobiographical fiction. And then in the various reports on it that other readers had made, and then I had relied, as Jonathan said, very heavily on this short volume of excerpts by Lawrence Sutton when I was writing my thesis. So I knew that it was immense and impossible, but I didn't actually know what it would be like to wade into it. So Laura brought me three boxes of file folders stuffed with handwritten pages. There are 91 file folders, and they are numbered 1 to 92, because one of them was not there anymore. But
it was mislabeled. It really shouldn't have been there. It's not a conspiracy. It was something from a different time period that was erroneously included.
They were numbered, but they were not in chronological order. So I was had no idea when I dipped into folder number one what it was, when he had written it, how representative it was, what I would find there. And my first read through was, I was just completely without any sense of up or down, because I didn't have a sense of what came first. I was encountering these ideas over and over again, sort of, it was like constantly changing examination of the same set of ideas, but I didn't know whether it went anywhere. I didn't know whether to look for it to go anywhere, or whether I had to give up all sense of control and let myself go into this brain, because that's what you are doing when you're reading the exegesis itself. You're just really inside this thinking brain that is a very manic thinking brain and never comes to any stop. So I spent a lot of time just kind of getting oriented, and my second time through I was able to start putting things in chronological order, and then I started being able to see that actually there was some order. There was even a story that I began to see of where he would, you know, starting in 1974, there was a period of writing letters, and the early exegesis is all letters, pretty much all letters. He was writing about the experience to anyone who would listen, and the experience itself was actually taking place as he wrote. So for the first about year, you've got these kind of action-packed letters. It's like a detective story that's going forward in front of you, and it's kind of exciting because he's starting to excavate the meaning of these events, and he's getting all of this information as he does it. Dreams are flooding in, voices speaking to him, visions, they're still happening. And then after that period, he starts really digging in with the research, and the sort of visions kind of slow down, and he starts taking notes towards Vallis, and so on. So that you start, there is actually a shape of these, of this journey that goes from 1974 to 1982 when he died, which began to come forward as I found my footing. So that was the beginning. And the other part of the beginning was that I immediately saw that I couldn't do this by myself, and that I didn't want to be alone inside the exegesis. And so I started recruiting co-readers, other readers. Eric was one of them, who I asked to also take some folders and help me both select from them and transcribe the selections. And so we got a whole team together of people doing that. So, which I think worked out really, really well. Yeah. I wouldn't have been able to transcribe this amount of material in the time we had if not for all that help.
One of the really interesting things about the exegesis is, as Pamela's suggesting, it's not a consecutive sequence of the development of his thoughts. It's a series of impulsive forays into the material. And he responds to things, and he goes on a run. He proposes a theory to himself, and he runs it to its end, or he runs it to the point where he's exhausted himself or its possibilities. And he will often then tend to collapse into stillness and sometimes renounce the entire project at that point. And then when it picks up again, it's as though he's beginning for the first time. He returns to the source of the vision and says, okay, now I'm going to do this right, and I'm going to begin again. And one of the interesting things that does is it creates a series of models for intellectual journeying. And in fact, it also imposed the same structure of the foray and then the retreat on our editorial efforts. You know, it sort of encodes the exhilaration of discovery and the collapse into despair that we went through again and again as we contended with the material. I really do think it represented a kind of emotional bravery on Pamela's part to live with the thing as long as she did. But we sometimes did have to kind of reel her back from from the precipice. And but I also think that it was incredibly moving in a way that this project required so many hands. And you know, the very first proposal that the exegesis ever be dealt with, which originated when it was living in Paul Williams' garage in Sonoma and was, you know, truly had no prospects whatsoever except in the idealism of a handful of fans, was crowdsourcing before crowdsourcing. It was a few pages had been handed out to a number of people, and they were transcribing it, you know, into very early computing programs, which, of course, are inaccessible now. So those early transcriptions all became a kind of another lost horizon that we just knew existed but couldn't look over. But it returned to its crowdsourced origins in a funny way at the end, with all the various people that we called into it. And I think I'll be able to turn over to Eric in a moment if I just set this up a bit further. We also, of course, quite naturally, at some point, we thought, well, gosh, this thing is so problematic, and so it's so suggestive, but so strange. What we need is like an ambassador from outside the Philip K. Dick universe to mediate for people. So we were, you know, and this is I'm literally reporting on my own thinking aloud. I kept saying to them, what we've got to do is get, you know, Oliver Sacks to introduce it, or we've got to get Lawrence Wexler to introduce it. You know, one of these like brilliant generalists who does a great job of speaking in a popular idiom about very scholarly or very esoteric matters. And I was thinking, who can be that person? But of course, asking someone to actually take responsibility to introduce and mediate the entire exegesis to a popular audience is basically asking someone to go temporarily mad. Because you can't do it quickly. Pamela was living with this thing for years, and she couldn't encompass it or paraphrase it readily. And so we retreated from this idea, and I started to realize, and this is where the blind man's elephant comes into play. I began to see, wait a minute, we don't need one liaison. What we need are a number of different people just responding to it. Because what that will do is model for the reader our experience as editors and their likely experience as readers, which is that you can't get your brain around the entirety, but you can make forays in and encounter parts that stimulate you and think about those provocations with enormous excitement. And so we got, you know, Steve Erickson, a novelist who'd also written about Philip K. Dick at one point. We got Catherine Hales, an academic who theorizes science fiction and technology. We got Jeffrey Kripal. Am I saying his last name right? Kripal, who's a academic with a inclination towards mysticism and theology. We got a genuine, in Gabriel McKee, we got a genuine Christian theological thinker who was also a very big Philip K. Dick fan. We got David Gill, who was kind of a representative from the active fan culture, you know, a real liaison to the Philip K. Dick readers out there, someone who'd been keeping the equivalent of a fanzine alive online. And then Pamela and I wrote annotations ourselves. But we also realized this job was too much for us, and so we needed Eric Davis, who was not only an annotator but became the orchestrator of the annotations. And he herded all these different smart cats into the room and said, I'm going to be your manager, and what you have to do is not understand the entirety, just read some of it, see what you think, and bounce some thoughts back to it. And we'll put those in as annotations. So instead of having one master introduction, which was never possible or likely, we have all these different people taking a look at the thing. So they're the blind man and it's the elephant. And Eric was the maestro of this process. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Well, first I just want to say this is really trippy for me because I was turned on to Philip K. Dick in 1985 when I lived in Berkeley for one summer at the notorious Barrington Hall. And it was a very weird summer. And I bought some of my first Dick books from that shelf over there and, you know, went on by the late 80s, I wrote my thesis on Dick because I was reading, I was totally obsessed with Phil Dick and Gnosticism and post-structuralist philosophy. And so I was already setting myself up to be able to kind of like be able to hang with this in a way for extended periods of time, because from a philosophical perspective, it's or a religious thought perspective, it's incredibly fascinating. I'm studying religious studies now, and the more I spend time with this material, the more I look at Dick in those lens rather than a literary lens, because it's sort of almost more fresh for me. And also you have this extraordinary, unparalleled document, this person who's undergoing, you know, absolutely profoundly bizarre and marvelous and strange and frightening and, you know, exhilarating experiences, and keeping this vast, recursive, iterative, highly intelligent, and then highly speculative manuscript in relationship to it. And he's also incredibly brilliant and with this completely bizarre imagination that we love. So it's just, it was a total gas to be able to work on this material. But then, as Jonathan said, it was very, very clear that, I mean, to me, one of the things that marks Dick from a mystical perspective as a religious thinker, which he is in the exegesis and even in his novels to varying degrees, is this profound sense of the inconclusiveness of any speculative endeavor, and that it's much more about the process, perhaps because you're obsessed and have no choice in it, perhaps because it is the muse for you, but that the world that is revealed is constantly undermining itself, and it's this kind of radical contingency even as it moves forward with tremendous spiritual depths and sometimes extraordinarily moving passages of supreme affect, you know, a kind of like Jacob Burma or Kafka, or I mean, it's full on at points. So it was just totally a gas. But obviously, in order to represent that, we wanted as many kind of voices as possible. So it wasn't just that we got this great crew of folks to work on the annotations, but they came from very different perspectives, and so they read it in very different ways. I was very happy to have Anne Catherine Hales, for example, because she's written about post-humanism. She's very interested in technology and literature, and she's very science-minded and skeptical. So she looked at this, what happened to Dick, as a brain event, and narrated it in terms of being a brain event, which is, of course, something that he himself did to varying degrees. That was one of the perspectives, or actually a number of perspectives. It's vitamins. It has to do with the corpus callosum. It has to do with, you know, particular frequencies. It's not a entirely mystical process. Most of the time, he had different approaches to it, but that was very important. And getting religious angles, getting philosophers, getting people who could hang with that speculative imagination, and then really just being able to move through the document and handle it. I think the most fun I had was going to visit the actual exegesis and pull out the folders when we needed to scan the many remarkable diagrams and doodles that are in the book, which is one of the best things about it. I mean, they were really remarkable little thought glyphs, very topographical, very alchemical in a certain way, very much like circuit diagrams. I mean, he was a very cybernetic thinker in a lot of ways, and you can see that in the way that he would diagram these various speculative schemes, which he would then kind of run through in an almost, sort of a kind of calculating, visionary way in through the material, through page after page after page. So actually being able to hold these things up and go through the material and see the intimacy of the ballpoint was just a total gas for me and for all of us. And it was gas that we needed in order to get the project done. And I'm very impressed that it's done and that it came out as good as it does. And you can't see the sausage maker too much because it's some sausage.
So unless there's something that you guys want to add before we make this a dialogue, I suspect that the best things will occur if we just really switch to questions and try to do our best to account for ourselves in reaction to them now. I saw one right up here.
Yeah, you stated that the first part you saw was in the form of some sort of correspondence. Were you looking at carbons?
Well, we have 1,600 letters that my dad wrote. I would say almost all of them are called first-person carbons or second-person carbons originals, but there are some that we only have copies and that were copied when they did the. There's six volumes of letters, and I believe what happened is people were sending their letters in to try and fulfill that. But those letters are all. We have all those letters, but one. in carbon. So there was only one that I found that I had to get off the internet.
The second part of that is, if you deal with responses to these letters.
No, and there's only one person who probably was really up to responding to my father, and that was, well, no, I just want to be honest. He wrote predominantly to three people. He wrote to, and you covered this in L.A., but he wrote to a young woman who was doing her Ph.D. dissertation, Claudia Bush Krenz, and I thought, oh, my God, if I was 20 or 22 and had this, or 24 and had these letters coming at me, they never met, but this was the initial person that was the beneficiary of these incredible, what would you call them?
Outpourings,
thank
and,
you.
And, I mean, Pamela, should you guys should correct me, but letters that ran into the tens and 20,
yeah.
20
and
page,
she
page
was,
lengths.
And God bless her. They had an interaction. You know, she emailed him back, but she was, I would say she was a recipient of this, what did you call it?
Outpouring. Yeah.
Then there was a second person, Dr. Patricia Warwick, who was Dr. Pat Warwick, who he thought was a man at first. And that she was actually probably as close to his intellectual equal as I have seen. I've read both sides of the correspondence, and she's written a book. She wrote a book, and they were very deep correspondence, two books. And then the third person he wrote to was Paul Williams, and I would say Paul Williams, who was his literary executor, he took it to a different notch. Patricia Warwick's was the most philosophical, the most dense letters, and she would actually respond, and she would trigger a different idea, and that's unique in her correspondence. And then he wrote to Paul Williams kind of about what was happening and his thoughts on it, and then he wrote to his agent more in a storyline. And sort of what had happened to him. But I would say those are the four people he really, and Malcolm Edwards he wrote to, and Malcolm Edwards thought he was insane.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
Can anything be said to the extent of this mode of writing that you're describing, can anything be said of how that connects to his other modes of writing, the short stories, the longer fiction? Just curious, was he writing this kind of thing sort of all his life in notebooks, and then, or is this something that he started after 74, and then this was a new mode for him?
I guess I can try to take that. The writing that is accounted for in this volume, and that he called the exegesis, begins very specifically after the visionary events in February and March of 74. That said, he was a graphomaniac in several phases of his writing life. I mean, in 1964, I believe he wrote six or seven novels, a couple of them masterpieces. Well, that's, from the perspective of a novelist, an outlandish thing to consider. He was always a voluminous correspondent, and I think it's also worth bringing into this that he was a magnificent and celebrated talker. People would come into his sphere and be regaled with all-night, you know, bull sessions, basically, on the nature of the universe. So there were all kinds of precursors for the explosiveness of the writing of the exegesis. But he did not commit any sustained, philosophical or theological writing until these visions came over him. It was all of those impulses were translated within the fiction or within his, you know, kind of his talk to that point.
Did this fiction output decrease then when he started writing this kind of material, or are they related, or perhaps he was already slowing down?
I think it's true that there are fewer novels in the last part of his life, while the exegesis is going on in the background. But that is it's very hard to make a controlled measure of the circumstances because his life was so very different in different parts. Different moments of his life, and he did commit in the last part of his life, and it's a pleasure to be able to say this, to a much more kind of considered and revised prose style in his fiction. And so you also have him slowing down as an artist for artistic purposes in that time frame.
I have a copy of one of his tapes. Do you have tapes?
Oh, we do. Oh, no, you mean written tapes where maybe he was, I'm not sure what you're asking.
There are cassettes of his speech, but why don't we talk about this afterwards? Thank you. Come up and tell us about it.
No,
hi. Okay.
Question for Pamela Jackson. What got cut? How would you characterize it? What's the best stuff that got cut?
Oh, well, it's more like what got selected, because actually probably 9 out of 10 pages got cut. So it was the process was about going through and finding what was the best writing, the most interesting thinking, the most excerptable thinking, and then trying to represent the most important sort of ideas, what was most important to him and what seemed most interesting and insightful to us. So we were pulling out of a mass, which hopefully eventually will also... other people will get to dig around in, because it was just such a joy when it wasn't a terrible ordeal to to look through these and find these, you know, wonderful, wonderful pieces.
Mike. It's a great question.
The introduction.
Well, I think that, I mean, it's a lovely question, and it's the sort of book that could, you know, invite all sorts of different strategies. I mean, I do think that Pamela did a superb job of discovering the degree to which there was a narrative to discover. She found it, and it's really actually surprised me. I mean, for all my familiarity with portions of this manuscript, it surprised me how, when I finally read her kind of, you know, rough assembly, as you would say in the film world, I thought, wait a minute, it is a book. It does have a progression, as long as you grant that it's not going to have any ending except falling off the cliff of mortality at the end. But I also think you could delve in according to your curiosity. You could just flip through it and find sequences that interested you. That you could then use the index to bounce back to concepts or motifs that were similar. I also think that for readers of his fiction, it's possible to decide to see what he has to say about your favorite of his novels, and to say, well, you know, because there one of the things that makes the exegesis so unique in as a piece of writing is from the perspective of a novelist considering his own novels. I can't think of any precedent for someone reading themselves with such a radical susceptibility to their own concepts. He will come across, you know, Maze of Death or Galactic Pot Healer, and suddenly, for that moment, it will seem as much to propose the solution to the mystery of all existence as, you know, Heidegger had the week before, or some other, instigating text. And so he'll read himself with this incredible intensity, as if it's a kind of almost like a gospel that's been handed down to him. So if you love one of the novels, you might go to the index and figure out where he's talking about that book. Another approach would be if you're very much in sympathy with one of the annotators, you could go and look for all of Eric's annotations, for instance, or all of Catherine Hale's or Gabriel McKee's, and follow that thread. It would be another way to get into the book.
Yeah, and another way is to, we work pretty hard on having a reasonably complete glossary, because I mean, he does throw a lot of terms out there. There's a lot of references to philosophers and poets and literary figures, and, you know, that can be very intimidating, and he was a voracious and very global and multidimensional intellect, but it's important to remember that he almost all of the time he was reading the encyclopedia. And so you too can read the encyclopedia. You can look at the glossary, or you sit there with your Wikipedia open, and when he mentions Parmenides and you're like, don't quite remember Parmenades, just pop on for a little, just a little hit, and you'll be able to kind of roll along. Because half the time that's what he's doing. He's more riffing with bits than like deeply engaging and like the complexities of these philosophers, and I think it's a much richer experience for that. You get a little bit of an education, and what happens is that all these voices start bouncing around your own head, and in a way, there was an earlier question about how this material gets reflected in the fiction, and it's really like the bowl sessions in Valis, and particularly the first half of Valis, where you see what happens when this kind of thinking and this kind of material becomes part of a social engagement and part of the way that people together try to work through and think through things. There's all the same kind of references to the same kinds of texts. Some of the lines are very similar to things you find in the exegesis. So in a way, the more that you can be at that late night, you know, bull session, going through this stuff with him, he's kind of, you know, monologuing, unsurprisingly. But, you know, you're there and you're kind of like riding the riffs. A lot of things, I think, will open up. And it will make more sense, because it does make sense. It makes a lot of very deep forms of sense, albeit in a kind of unusual way.
Hi.
Well, he did somewhat to me. He definitely shared an experience that he had with, the way he described it was an angel that was above my brother while he was playing in a sandbox. And he talked to me about this experience, and he had tears, and he was sobbing. And I knew that whatever it was that he experienced, whatever connection it was that he had, was very, very real. So for me as a, you know, kid, I was impressed that obviously he was very passionate about something. It was a little scary, but I got it. That, well, I would have been 12-ish. And he described a few other things, but that's the one that stands out most in my mind. I think he was a little hesitant to get too into it, because it would have been extremely confusing, you know, for a kid. And I can't speak for Laura, but do you have any recollection?
My answer is no. He never spoke to me about it. He never wrote about it. And I think the reason that he did is I think he wanted my approval. And he very much interacted with me as almost my age. I was in my 20s, or 74. I was 14 through 22 when he passed away. And he interacted with me as if he was an older teen. And I think it was important for him that I thought he was cool. And I think he didn't venture into that area because I think he thought I wouldn't see it as cool. And he was right. I would have been scared to death.
Hi.
Another question for the daughters. The typing was sort of unbelievable. I read about that 120 words a minute.
He did what do they call the chicken? What do they call the pecking? He really didn't
hunt and peck.
He was so fast. I mean, I remember that about it. But it was the fastest I've ever seen anyone type. But I don't know. Maybe Laura has other recollections.
So our father, who art in heaven, he left when I was 3 and a half. And when he wrote, when he was married to my mom, who was his third wife, he was writing in this little cabin around the corner that they called the hovel. I'm not sure exactly why. I could read, you know, go back to the different theories. So I didn't see it, but anecdotally, my mother talked about it all the time, that he would write a book in 2 weeks, literally just go and not sleep. And then, of course, she had no idea whatsoever that there was any amphetamines involved. That just never even occurred to her. It wasn't even part of her life context until after he left, and there were a number of pharmacies that sent bills to the house. So that was her first glimpse that there was something that was maybe external that was doing this. My mom's a very smart woman, but she didn't have that life experience.
He was just using the two fingers. He wasn't like the...
He was
Oh, it was definitely man. Oh, no, didn't he have a selectric
later,
in the end?
Later,
he had a selectric in the end. It had one of those ball things.
Yeah.
Did it? Was that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hi. Right in the center there. Hi.
Hi. I live down by Alston and McGee, and the mythology is that Philip lives right around the corner from me on Alston. Is that where you grew up, or do you remember living there at all?
I lived in Point Reyes my entire life. Was born in San Francisco, so never lived in Berkeley. But we drove around and looked at all the houses, East and I, one day, and I have all the addresses written down. We actually, I went to the Berkeley Historical Society and looked them up in the phone book and found residences that nobody had known about. So I can't really say exactly where it was, but he lived in the Flatlands. He lived on Bancroft at one time. He lived on Alston at one time. So
Francisco Street.
Francisco Street is where the house, little house, was. And last time I looked, it was for sale. It's awful cute, but there's just no way I'm buying that house. So he always said he lived in the Flatlands.
Hi, up on the stairs.
Well, he passed away just before Blade Runner was released. So, and I think he had a fantastic experience on set seeing pieces of it. So he was very, very excited about that. But, you know, back in that day, I mean, that was the first adaptation that was made. And once that film came out, and it was a total flop, basically. You know, the critics hated it. Nobody went and saw it. I think we assumed, and it made sense, that we wouldn't see any other adaptations based on his work. I think he would have just been beside himself. He would have been thrilled to see some mainstream recognition, and it's just too bad that he didn't get to see that. But it's quite amazing, the trajectory.
I will say this, if you've read his letters, he liked to tell people good things that were happening to them. You always kind of get the feeling that it wasn't braggadocio. There was a different feeling to it. It was like, he wanted people to know that he was doing well for the reason that he wanted to be accepted, I think. I really feel that when I read everything, that there was this yearning, and so he's telling people, I'm making lots of money now, or whatever. But I'm giving it all away to the starving children in New York City. But, seriously, that's it. But he was very excited about the films, and being in Orange County, there was an even bigger linkage for him because he was sort of down in that area. And he was in love with Victoria Principal, and he thought she was, you know, he's trying to get her to be Rachel in Blade Runner. And he started kind of getting the lingo of the films when he was writing his letters, and you kind of got this little Hollywood vibe going on. So I think he was really into it and really enjoyed that.
I think we can take a couple more questions, and then obviously there's a lot of books to sign. And hi. I think Pamela should take that question. I'll just say it's very tricky. You have to be certain to remember that he might have gone on writing this way for another 8 or 10 years if he'd lived. We have no idea. So where the book happens to land and where he was in the last phases, there are tonalities that are very, it's very inviting to think, oh, he was preparing to be done in some way. And there is a kind of ebbing in some ways towards the end, which is probably the energies of his life ebbing. And that influenced the writing, because the writing was so interpenetrative of his temperament and his mood and his physical capacity to keep going. But
He's basically schooled himself in philosophy over the course of these 8 years. I mean, he's been interested in philosophy all along, but you can see in the beginning in 1974, he's starting to do research, and it's really fun, actually, in the beginning. You can see, like, he's copying out whole entries from the encyclopedia about the logos, or, you know, just starting to figure out all these terms. By the by 1980, 81, the philosophy is very dense. It's getting much more difficult. There's a lot more heavy Christian, Neoplatonism, some stuff that was very hard to excerpt and didn't make it into the book. So philosophically, that was where he was, I think, toward the end. But the overall arc is you do just feel the density just and the sort of the weight of all the thinking just really getting heavier. Even though there's also toward the end just really wonderful light moments and also great back and forths about his his last novel, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer, and then some thinking about the novel that he didn't ever get to write, Owl in Daylight. So it continues to be mixed, and he also continues to go back to the first things, the things that obsessed him from the beginning. So it's not one narrative of getting somewhere, but it does change. The feeling of it and the philosophy, I think, changes.
Hi, John.
A whimsical question. Moe's book was certainly present from 1974 until Fifth Death. Did he ever mention?
He was in Fullerton and in Santa Ana. He was. He left Marin, went to Vancouver, and then had someone reach a hand out to him. And he went to Southern California in Orange County and never really came back.
For Berkeley, the landmarks, apart from those homes, are the Lucky Dog Pet Shop, which he wrote a very poignant essay about, and Tupper and Reed, which was the survivor of the two music stores where he was employed the last time he had a job before he became a full-time freelance writer. He worked at a store called Art Music for a long time, and then briefly, I think, at Tupper and Reed, which when I was living in Berkeley was still surviving on Shattuck. I don't know if it's there anymore. But so those are.
This film has been trying to answer,
but oh yeah.
For quite a while.
Great. Was there? Oh, the books that are regarded as the Vallis trilogy begin with Vallis. That's the title of the first, and then the Divine Invasion, and then the last novel published in his lifetime, and the last he wrote, which was called The Transmigration of Timothy Archer. Hi, back there.
When you go into this mess, just really tell you the information and thought, it sounds like you took on a basket of snakes. How did you end up sorting all that rich stuff that was in there? And do you get a flavor of when you read the extras?
I think it's pretty good representative of the exegesis, and it also spares you actually having to slog through everything else. We tried really hard to pick out everything that when something new came along to give that representation, and also to mix up both smaller fragment, you know, sometimes there'll be something that's as little as a line that we excerpted, and other times it'll be several pages. So you actually can, if you want to, feel like what it's like to actually have him take you through a thought process for a while. So we tried to represent it as, and yet also make it still readable as much as possible. And I think it's great, personally. I think we did a great job.
Maybe that's enough, and we can come and say hello to you up here if you've got a book for us to sign. Thank you very much for coming.